two Republicans against one Democrat would have been a pretty tough path for victory.
Republican Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom drops out of the race for Alaska's seat in the U.S. House. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 23rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how satellite internet has disrupted traditional telecoms in rural Alaska.
People that had the Starlink transformers on the roof, the flat white antennas that you see everywhere now in the village, used to go around town to see who else had Starlink, and now they go around town to see who doesn't have Starlink.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Alaska Republican Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom has dropped out of the race for the state's lone U.S. House seat. Dahlstrom made the announcement in a statement today after placing third in Tuesday's primary election. She received 20% of the vote, with incumbent Democrat Mary Peltola leading with over 50% and Republican Nick Begich III at just under 27%. In her statement, Dahlstrom said her goal remains defeating Peltola. She said that the best thing she could do to realize that goal is to withdraw. Republican political strategist Matt Shukaro has worked on numerous campaigns in the past and says Dahlstrom dropping out sets the stage for a head-to-head race against Peltola.
It's been fairly clear from the beginning that two Republicans against one Democrat would have been a pretty tough path for victory. And so now that Nick has essentially cleared the field, it's time to make it count and to deliver on that message.
Dahlstrom had been endorsed by former President Donald Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson. Meanwhile, Begich garnered endorsements from a variety of Republican district committees. He previously made a commitment to drop out of the race if Dahlstrom received more votes than he did in the primary in an effort to not split Republican votes in the general. But even with Dahlstrom out, Shukaro says beating Peltola won't be easy.
She has been able to fundraise significant amounts of money, more than we've ever seen in a congressional race in the history of Alaska. And so the clock is ticking, and the question is, will Republicans come together and unite behind Nick Begich? I think they probably will.
The top four candidates in the primary advance to November's ranked choice general election. In the most recent election results, Republican candidate Matthew Salisbury claims the third spot on the ballot, and Alaska Independence Party candidate John Wayne Howe is in fourth. But combined, they have only about 1% of the vote. The Division of Elections will continue counting primary ballots until August 30th and expects to certify the results September 1st. The general election is on November 5th. A bellwether trial is set to begin Monday in a fight over whether the parent companies of two Alaska grocery chains can merge. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea has this update.
The Federal Trade Commission wants to block Kroger from buying out Albertsons. Together, they own 35 stores in Alaska under the Fred Meyer, Kars, and Safeway brands, plus Crow Creek Mercantile in Girdwood. Most Alaskans live in a community where the stores directly compete with each other. Across the country, the two grocery giants own about 5,000 stores. The case is before a federal judge in Oregon. It's the first of four overlapping legal challenges to reach the trial stage. The judge in this case is supposed to rule on whether or not to halt the merger, while more substantive arguments go before an administrative law judge in Washington, D.C. The trial is expected to last 3 weeks. The Oregon judge's decision won't necessarily make or break the merger, but if the FTC wins, the cost to the companies of continuing the legal fight, uncertainty, and delays may lead them to abandon the merger. Kroger and Albertsons want to merge so they can be more competitive with even bigger retailers and other retailers that have expanded into groceries. To avoid creating local monopolies, they intend to sell off hundreds of their competing stores to a separate grocery wholesaling company to operate. That includes 17 Kars and Safeways in Alaska, plus the store in Girdwood. The companies claim the deal will improve competition without the loss of any frontline workers' jobs or store closures. They've also promised to spend billions of dollars to lower prices, improve worker benefits, and improve stores. However, there isn't anything in place to hold them to those promises. The Federal Trade Commission, consumer advocacy groups, grocery labor unions, and a lot of elected officials and regular people don't believe the companies. They think the merged company would be too powerful and will end up hurting regular shoppers and workers. Until recently, there was one local chapter of a grocery workers union to come out in support of the merger. United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555, which represents 35,000 workers in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington, publicly backed the merger in February. But amid labor negotiations that soured this month, Local 555 withdrew its support. Its leaders said Kroger had repeatedly failed to fulfill its labor commitments and is letting workers and customers down. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Wild Alaska berries are one of the most nutritious and antioxidant-rich foods available. But climate change is altering where berries grow in Alaska and when. So researchers at the University of Alaska Fairbanks are gathering data to make sure Alaskans can pick both wild and cultivated berries in the decades to come. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
About 10 years ago, Janelle Winter noticed that berries in Metlakatla were much smaller than normal. So did a lot of other people in the community. Some berries were completely dried up. Some berry bushes produced a second or even third set of flowers to try to reproduce. It was one of the early warning signs of what would later be officially deemed a regional drought.
And then all of a sudden, all of those indicators that we had been taking note of made sense. It all kind of fell into place.
Winter works for the Metlakatla Indian community in Southeast Alaska. She says she's also noticed other changes in berries since moving to Metlakatla 3 decades ago. She says service berries, or Saskatoon, are thriving.
Now we're seeing more and more and more of it, and I'm purely speculating that it's because it prefers the drier conditions. It also likes more sunlight, so it's moving into the developed areas.
Metlakatla is just one of many Alaskan communities noticing dramatic changes in berry production. In the past few years, people have reported late salmon berries in Seldovia, insects on cloudberries in Trapper Creek, oddly shaped low bush cranberries in Anchorage, and early blueberries in Fairbanks. Changes like this impact berry harvests that Alaskans rely on for nutrition, culture, and connection to their environment. And berries are expensive to import, so many Alaskans can't replace them in their diet if they have a low harvest year. Katie Spellman is a researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, or UAF. She says she hears reports on changes in berries from communities throughout the state.
In some places, it's changing abundance or timing of the berries. And in some places, it's increasing insect pests on their plants or flowers frying up due to wind or drought conditions.
For the past 2 decades, UAF has been collecting reports from Alaskans. And scientists are collecting data on berry size and quality, life cycle timing, and impacts of snowpack to help better understand the impact of climate change. The good news, Spellman says, is that Alaska berries are not going to disappear.
None of them are going extinct. They might shift their regions so that we have to start using other berries as substitutes for the ones that we've traditionally picked.
But she says because of climate change, Alaska now experiences more variation year to year in temperature, rainfall, and snowfall. All those factors impact berries in a wide variety of ways. Because climate change impacts are unpredictable, Spellman says the best way communities can adapt is to have a diversity of berry plants. She says communities are getting creative to make sure they have access to berries long term. One solution she loves is for blueberries in Hoonah.
They're actively managing the canopy in certain patches on north side and south side of slopes so that in hot years, the north side is more productive and in cold years, the south side is more productive so that they always have some sort of berry patch for their community to go to.
In Metlakatla, Janelle Winter is part of a team working to increase resilience and food security. Because the community has noticed service berries are thriving, they're including the species in their unfolding food forest plan. Winter says they're planting as many fruiting and edible plants as they can throughout the community, swapping them out when ornamentals need replacing.
We're all really working hard to try to make sure that we're preserving these species for future use, as well as trying to document the knowledge associated with how to use and how to preserve the various berries.
She and her colleagues are working with kids to plant, harvest, and gather data about berries and other fruit in Metlakatla. They hope that means people in Metlakatla can harvest berries for many generations to come. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
UAF is holding a free online class August 28th from noon to 1 p.m. for Alaskans who want to learn more about climate change impacts on berries and how their communities can adapt. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, bison find a new home in the interior, but not everybody's welcoming them.
There was a directive from the governor to move forward with the bison project before the planning team was done.
That's ahead. Stay with us. The availability of high-speed internet from Starlink satellites has, by most accounts, been revolutionary in rural parts of Alaska. Elders in villages can have face-to-face conversations with their grandkids living far away. The owners of broken-down snow machines are able to watch videos showing how to fix them. A search and rescue crew even used Starlink to see social media posts that helped them find teenagers lost in a snowstorm. And as Starlink continues to gain users, it's forced traditional telecommunications companies, who've raked in hundreds of millions of dollars in federal subsidies, to compete. Reporter Jenna Koontz wrote about Alaska's Starlink revolution recently for the Anchorage Daily News. Koontz says the shift in many far-flung communities where the ubiquitous white, shoebox-sized Starlink receivers are sitting outside more and more homes has been profound.
They're able to do so much, from attending school online and being able to search Google for the first time. One woman had never used a search engine under her own roof before. One gentleman, Earl Achuk in Shewak, Alaska, uses it for his search and rescue crew and has been able to locate missing girls that had gone missing when they were coming to or from a basketball tournament in the winter during a blizzard. A major thing that I heard from everyone that had these other facets of how they use it was communication with their family. You know, they're able to FaceTime and be close to people that don't otherwise still live in the village or live in their small towns on a regular basis, and in a way that they can't imagine their lives without it anymore.
Yeah, totally. So how did this all happen? That's like a big question, but you've got satellites. That part, I think people understand that mm-hmm. You can get internet from satellites. But there were traditional terrestrial telecommunications companies before. So how did Starlink come in and, like, I guess you would say disrupt that?
The market.
Yeah.
So it took someone that was able to self-fund this project, like the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, to be able to deploy these independent low Earth orbit satellites and sell them at a market rate that is faster internet for a lesser price. You know, there's 32 telecommunication carriers in the state of Alaska, but the big ones, like we know, like GCI, their product has remained a lot less competitive. And part of that is because these eligible telecommunication companies receive large amounts of federal dollars in subsidies to provide internet to, like, hospitals and schools, but also to homes. And the definition of what it takes to be a eligible communication company means you have to also provide voice service. So smaller companies don't have access to that funding. Sean Williams from Pacific Dataport calls it like a David and Goliath scenario. Like, it's an impossible situation to go up against such a large sum of money to deploy internet in these small places. So that's why it took an entrepreneur that was able to self-fund the project, and Starlink didn't even become profitable to Elon Musk until last year.
So, I mean, you mentioned that those flagship telecoms are now in a position of having to compete with Starlink. What did they tell you about that? I mean, things that they're trying to do to be able to compete.
Yeah, that's a good question. I spoke with GCI as the lone giant telecommunication provider for this story, and they say that they have been thinking about this for a while before Starlink was even on the ground, of how to better provide internet access to their more remote locations. And they have several projects going, I think two that they're building out. And, you know, their main rallying cry, it seems, is also that their fiber, so providing, like, infrastructure in the ground, is better than satellite service. But that remains to be seen as well, if that's true and why that might be true.
So, I mean, I guess as GCI and others maybe look to compete with Starlink, you wrote in your story, I mean, meantime, Starlink just continues to gain users, right? Is there any sense, I guess, either from the Facebook page or from Starlink itself, how many people have logged on or, you know, bought into Starlink?
That was a number that was hard to get because it's proprietary information on all ends. So Starlink itself, the organization, never responded to a request for comment. And GCI says that's proprietary information of how many clients they've lost And I was able to look at their, I didn't get into this in the article, but try to look at their year-end budget statements to see, like, because they write amount of userships and it's confusing. You have to extrapolate the data and it's not exact numbers, which is why I didn't include it. But the GCI said themselves that they've seen a significant change in usership. And then colloquially, I've heard, you know, that these folks in towns like Utqiagvik and in Chivak as well used to go around like the some of the first people that had the Starlink transformers on their roof, the flat white antennas that you see everywhere now in the village, used to go around town to see who else had Starlink, and now they go around town to see who doesn't have Starlink. So yeah. You just can see anecdotally that it has taken over.
That was reporter Jenna Koontz, who wrote about Starlink's ascendance in rural Alaska for the Anchorage Daily News. You can find her full story at ADN.com. Scientists had previously linked the crash of the Bering Sea snow crab population to warming ocean waters, but a new study released by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration this week deepens the connection between human-caused climate change and the die-off. As KMXT's Davis Hovey reports, the new study outlines further changes coming to the Arctic.
Mike Litzo is the lead author of the report and is the director of NOAA's Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Kodiak. Snow crabs are well suited for Arctic conditions, but Litzo says the southeastern Bering Sea is changing to more subarctic conditions through a process called borealization. It's a process that's also happening in terrestrial ecosystems in Alaska.
You know, like an Arctic terrestrial ecosystem, say around Kotzebue, is traditionally tundra. You know, you don't have shrubs. But as you borealize, you get more shrubs and even trees. And so you can imagine like what a huge transition it is to go from tundra to forest. And it's the same kind of thing going from ice associated to no ice all year.
This borealization brought on by human-caused climate change means warmer conditions and more negative effects for snow crab in the southeastern Bering Sea. That includes a greater abundance of predator species like Pacific cod, shifts in food availability for crabs, and increased bitter crab disease, which can be fatal. Litzo and his team had previously confirmed that a combination of these factors caused the crash of snow crab populations between the years 2018 and 2019. The population still has not recovered. And after the last two back-to-back years without a commercial fishery, which is estimated to be worth roughly $230 million annually, fishermen have also not fully recovered. And the snow crab most likely never will. The new report indicates the fishery may be entirely displaced in the coming decades. Litzo says the recent changes are not part of a one-off event, and ecosystem-wide changes are expected to continue to affect snow crab populations into the future.
So it's not like we're going to lose snow crab anytime soon, but we should expect the southern limit of their range to be retracting north, you know, fairly rapidly.
There is still hope for a short-term recovery of snow crab over the next 5 years, however, based on favorable abundance seen during a 2022 bottom trawl survey. But otherwise, Litzo and his team say the southeastern Bering Sea may only see Arctic conditions 8% of the time in the years to come. As for this year's snow crab commercial fishing season, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is expected to make a decision on opening or closing the fishery in October. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
A burled spruce log destined to become the new finish line of the Iditarod has been selected. Veteran Iditarod musher Ramey Smith is leading the effort to build the new arch. KNOM's Ben Townsend has more.
The arch will be carved from white spruce found near Seward, the site of the iconic sled dog race's historic start line. 27-time Iditarod finisher Ramey Smith says the approximately 5,000-pound log was selected after a summer-long search. Once logs for the arch and support pillars are prepared, that is, stripped of bark, sanded, and polished, they'll need time to dry, a process Smith says can take months. Then, the musher and log home builder will get to work on making his next mark on Iditarod history, an assignment he says he holds in high regard.
First moment I was selected, I understood the responsibility and what it means to a lot of people and means to Alaska.
Smith's involvement brings a deep personal connection to the project, given his family's rich history with the race. His mother, Lolly Medley, was one of the two first women to finish the event. His father, Bud Smith, raced in the first ever Iditarod back in 1973. While Smith doesn't plan to race in next year's Iditarod, he's committed to ensuring that the arch is ready to welcome future mushers and their supporters to Nome.
So I'm going to have the people of Alaska in mind when I'm working on the arch.
City of Nome Mayor John Handland announced at August 12th City Council meeting that Nome's Marty Silvernail will help build the platform the arch will rest on. The second iteration of the iconic World Arch collapsed last April after serving for over two decades. Handland feels confident that with Silvernail's help, the new arch will serve for generations to come.
All I can say that if Marty is involved in the process, it's not going to fall down in 20 years or whatever. It'll be built like a brick.
Once complete, the arch will be flown from Smith's shop in Willow to Nome just in time for March's finish of next year's race. In Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has taken a major step toward establishing a wood bison herd in the Minto Flats State Game Refuge west of Fairbanks. It's the second effort to restore the species in Alaska, and some interior Alaska Native groups are concerned about the project. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Fish and Game imported the wood bison from Alberta, Canada's Elk Island National Park, which provides animals for restoration efforts like the one targeting Alaska's Minto Flats State Game Refuge. Fish and Game wood bison biologist Tom Seaton says the bison were trucked in from Canada this spring and temporarily cared for at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Large Animal Research Station, then barged down the Tanana River to the refuge at the end of July.
There were five containers full of bison with 36 yearlings and five adults.
Seaton says the animals were offloaded into a 100-acre fenced area.
Some of them came off real slow. They just walked off kind of quietly and slow. And then some of them kind of jumped and ran off, you know, real quick. But they all did it safely.
Seaton says the bison seem to be acclimating well, emphasizing that there's plenty for them to eat.
Enjoying all the nice wild forages that are there in the pen. We've brought some hay out for supplemental feed and some other pellets and things for them to eat. And they're not eating much of what we have to offer because there's such good food out there in the meadow that they've got available to them.
Seaton says the plan is to transport another 20 wood bison to the refuge this month. He says Fish and Game staff will remain camped on site to oversee the herd through the winter.
Kind of supervising that whole process of rewilding them.
Fish and Game plans to release the wood bison from the enclosure this spring after greenup. It's the second effort to reestablish the animals in Alaska where they went extinct over a century ago. The first restoration project was initiated in the lower Yukon-Innoko Rivers area in 2015, and the herd has struggled due to some heavy snow winters. Seaton says the Minto Flats Refuge has good forage and generally lesser snowpack, but some interior Alaska Native tribes and organizations, including the Nenana Native Association, question the project.
Because our people do not have a history with bison.
Nenana Native Association First Chief Caroline Ketzler notes that the Tanana Chiefs Conference unanimously passed a resolution opposing the project at its annual convention this spring, and she lists several issues.
The environmental impact on our land and our animals, the treatment of the animals, as we know they may or may not live, the location being so close to cultural sacred sites. We do not have an updated environmental assessment, allocation of the bison and traditional ceremonial use, and then, of course, the lack of tribal consultation.
Ketzler is part of a Fish and Game wood bison restoration planning team, which she says did not decide on a location for the second project.
And there was a directive from the governor to move forward with the bison project before the planning team was done with the process.
Notified by the Fish and Game Commissioner that the planning team was to focus on a new population of wood bison on the Minto Flats Game Refuge.
Division of Wildlife Conservation Deputy Director Darren Bruning underscores that the directive followed thorough review and consideration.
Arguably, it is the most extensive outreach and planning process that Fish and Game has engaged in, at least in recent memory.
Bruning says the department strived to include anyone who reached out and had interest in the project.
But in addition, we did considerable, significant effort to visit communities, and we invited people to different functions and specifically reached out to these groups over a long period of time.
An email response from Division of Wildlife Conservation Interior and Northwest Arctic Regional Supervisor Lincoln Parrott adds that the department understands that the reintroduction of wood bison is not universally supported and that all input was, quote, carefully considered. Fish and Game Seton says the whole project, bison included, will cost about $200,000 and is being paid for with federal Pittman-Robertson funds from a tax on the sale of firearms. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early, Jeremy Shea, and Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Davis Hovey in Kodiak, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.